Last week we talked about truth systems. You might call them worldviews, belief systems. They're a grid that you view the whole world and everything that happens to you through. So it's just think of it as a grid. They define what you believe to be true. When you're not sure about anything, these things that make up your truth system, these things are true. These things you can hang on to like an anchor. And that's what Daniel was doing in this account of the events of his life. Now, I and other homeschool dads teach a class on worldviews to our high schoolers. Our three boys have been through it. Melissa's just graduated from this program, and Beth Ann and Amanda are about to enter. And it takes 3 years, and it covers history from ancient times all the way up through the present. And we examine these different worldviews or truth systems by asking seven questions. And I'd have Melissa recite them for you, but in order to save time, I'm going to do this. So number one, is there a God or a gods or gods? If so, what is he or they like? What is the nature and origin of the universe? What is the nature of man? What is the basis for ethics and morality? What defines right and wrong? What is the cause of evil and suffering? You know, evil and suffering are in the world today. People look at that and they go, well, you know, here's all the different reasons for that. What happens to man at death? That's a question that people answer. And what is the meaning of life and history? Now, you can take these seven questions and apply them to any truth system. The philosophy of the Greeks, the movies of Star Wars, the New Age movement, and you can find out what that worldview or truth system believes. Now, last week we looked at the truth system that defines Daniel's life. We said last week that at the age of 15 to 18, Daniel was taken from his home, from his family. The city of Jerusalem was besieged and captured. The royalty and the nobles, the fighting men, the craftsmen, anyone who was anyone was marched 1,500 miles up into Syria and then down the Tigris and Euphrates rivers to Babylon in modern-day Iraq. The temple that Solomon built was ransacked. The articles in the temple, the golden candlesticks, all of that stuff that was made of precious metals, it was all cut into pieces and carried to Babylon. Everything that Daniel held dear to him, his way of life, his way of worship, they were all done away with. Daniel finds himself in a leadership development program lasting 3 years. And it's designed to turn these young men into Babylonians, able to help assimilate the Jewish population into Babylonian culture and practice. They were taught Babylonian literature and language. They were schooled in the religious practices of the Babylonians. Their names were changed. They were being redefined before their very eyes. In a way, they were being brainwashed. We're scrubbing away your old self, and we're going to define you anew. The idea was to erase everything they knew from their old life and make them leaders in this new world. And many went along with the program. But we see four young men who didn't. Daniel and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, balked at the king's food and drink that they were offered as part of this program. Now, we don't know why. We don't know whether it was food that was specifically prohibited by the Mosaic Law, or whether it was food offered to idols. We don't know why. It doesn't say. But you see their truth system in action. You see, these four young men answer to a higher law than the one that they operated in. God told them that certain foods were prohibited. They could not eat them. All that we know was that these young men knew that without a shadow of a doubt, if they ate this food, they would be defiled. unclean, unfit for service to the God of heaven. Now they proposed another idea to the authorities. They appealed with another plan, and they left the results up to God and these officials. They said, test us in this for 10 days. Give us vegetables and water and see how we do. Afterwards, deal accordingly with us. That's the very words in Scripture. You make the decision. And they left it up to God. Now God granted them favor in the eyes of these officials. And at the end of 10 days, they seemed better and fatter than all the other young men who didn't object to the food and drink, the ones who failed to act on their convictions. Daniel and his friends were driven by their truth systems to act. What they knew to be true, the convictions that they held, made them take the risk to stand up and ask for another way. Pretty gutsy move. That's what truth systems do. They cause you to act accordingly. You will always act according to your truth system. You may not do it consciously, you might not think about truth systems, but you will act according to what you believe to be true. It's what we've talked about before. Creeds come before deeds. Doctrine, what you believe to be true, drives our deeds, drives our actions. If we have no doctrine, if we hold to no creeds, then our deeds will be tossed to and fro like waves on the ocean. We will have no anchor. We'll do whatever everyone else is doing. We'll blend in, take on the shape of the prevailing truth, if you can call it that. Truth with a small t. Now, I want to look at three features of Daniel's truth system. In a way, these are three ways that you can answer one of those seven questions that I gave you before. The first is that Daniel's truth system told him that God was sovereign and active in the affairs of men. Daniel was very much in a Job-like experience. Everything important to him was done away with. And yet Daniel knew that God was not defeated. Daniel knew that God was active and working, and that this terrible time was part of God's plan. Now we're going to dance around this book today. I would encourage you to take some more time in your private Bible study to look at the book of Daniel. Spend more time in this book and look into these accounts more closely. A lot of people get freaked out by Daniel because it's a different kind of book. You know, there's all kinds of visions. There's all kinds of strange creatures you see in these visions. And in many ways, Daniel is very much the revelation of the Old Testament because it's a looking into the future. Some of the things that he prophesied have come true. Some of them have yet to come true. But you have all these dreams and visions. You have beasts with four horns. You have, statues with feet of clay. You have God revealing the future. And it's challenging. Some of it's challenging. But I challenge you to take some time and spend some time there. Get yourself a good study Bible with some good Orthodox notes and watch the way that God was working through the lives of these men. So Daniel's truth system told him that God was sovereign and acting in the lives of men. In chapter 2, you have the incident of the king's dream. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king, had this dream, and it troubled him. And he brings in the wise men, all of the smart guys in the kingdom, and he tells them to tell him the meaning of this dream. And they say, well, that's easy, king. You tell us the dream, and we'll tell you the meaning. And he says, no, I'm not going to do that. And you can tell the king does not trust these men, because he says something along the lines of, you're going to tell me what you want to tell me. He says, I'll tell you what, you tell me the dream, and then tell me the interpretation. And then I'm going to know that the gods have told you. Well, the wise men and the conjurers were stumped. They didn't know what crazy dream the king had. They had no idea. It could be anything. So the king says, fine, I'm going to kill the lot of you. Every single one of these wise men, wise with quotes around it, I'm going to kill them all. So word gets out that all of these guys are sentenced to be killed. And it so happens that Daniel and his friends are in this class of individuals. Now, they weren't brought in to this initial consultation. They hear about it, and they say, oh, by the way, you're scheduled to be put to death. And so Daniel says, well, what's up? And so they tell him. Daniel and his friends, though, have a different truth system than these pagan wise men, and they know that there's a reason for what's going on. These young men know that God is sovereign and that he is active in the affairs of men. These young men know that God is using Nebuchadnezzar, this lost pagan king. God has used him to bring judgment on Israel. And God's probably doing something here. So let's pick it up in Daniel chapter 2, verse 14. Daniel 2:14. Then Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He said to Arioch, the king's commander, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? Then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Then Daniel went to his house and informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, about the matter, so that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men in Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel said, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what it is, what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. Even now you have made known to me what we requested of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. Daniel understood that God was revealing the future to King Nebuchadnezzar. He was again using this pagan king to reveal part of his program. And you can read the rest in chapter 2. It's a prophecy about how God is going to be raising up different Gentile kingdoms throughout history, a rather detailed account of the fall of Babylon to the Medes and the Greeks, the rise of the Roman Empire, and the overcoming of all these Gentile kingdoms by the kingdom of Christ at the end of time. It's pretty amazing stuff. And you might ask why God is using this pagan king to reveal this. Why not give it to a prophet of God? It's because God is sovereign and he uses pagan kings to accomplish his plan. Look at how he used Pharaoh and the Egyptians in the Exodus. God is able to use anyone to accomplish his purpose. And verse 2:21 says it all. He removes kings and establishes kings. God is constantly working, even in our day, removing leaders, establishing leaders to accomplish his purposes. Throughout this book, you see God moving and active in the lives of men. Now, this book has many miracles in it. The rescue of the three friends from the fiery furnace, the revealing of the dream to Daniel, the story of the lion's den. Throughout, you see God ruling, establishing his plans, fulfilling his purposes, not just in the lives of these young men, but with kings and kingdoms. God is doing what he's doing. He is not thwarted by the fact that someone might be lost and not paying attention to him. So is that how you see God today? Is God here now, living and active, ruling in our history, doing his will not just in your life, but in history, our history? Or is he just out there somewhere, not really paying attention, and all this stuff going on down here is just happening? How you answer that question determines and defines your truth system. How you answer that question will determine how you live and how you see and view life. Now, secondly, Daniel's truth system told him that he was placed there by God. God had a purpose for Daniel. And Daniel was right where God wanted him to be. Now, Daniel was in the midst of God's will, in spite of the fact that it was an awful situation. It's easy for us to look at a bad situation and say, this is bad, this is not right, this is not the way it's supposed to be. And yet Daniel didn't see it that way. Now let's think for a moment. Why was Daniel in this place? And this is a time for you to talk. Why was Daniel put where he was? What would be a reason that he was going through this cataclysm in his life?
God's glory can be revealed.
Okay, so God's glory could be revealed. Absolutely. And you see that through this book. God is glorified, even in the midst of this bad situation.
I think another thing is we have to realize that even though God, he ordains the ends as far as what's going to come to pass, he also ordains the means by which it's going to occur.
Yep.
So Daniel and his friends are means sovereignly that God has ordained by which his will be accomplished.
That's right. I agree completely. I mean, Daniel is there for a specific purpose. God is using Daniel. And Daniel knew that. Daniel was in a high position in the king's court, privy to all that was going on, for a reason. Let's look at a couple of reasons. Daniel was there to show the Gentile kings that God existed and that he needed to be worshipped. I think one of Daniel's purposes was an evangelistic one. If you look back through the history of the Jews, that's why God had the Jews where they were. The Jews were to display God to the world. Their purpose was evangelistic. They were positioned at this crossroad in history. If you look at a map of the Middle East and you look at the trade routes of that day, all of the major roads passed through this little rocky bunch of rocks called Israel. And God placed his people there so that they would testify of him. Now, Daniel was in an evangelistic position. He had access to, like I said, the highest people in the kingdoms of the world at that time. He was a voice for God to these pagan kings. And we must say that he was an effective voice. Nebuchadnezzar certainly makes several statements showing that he understands that Daniel's God is the Lord of all gods. Let's look at 2:46 and 47, chapter 2, verses 46 and 47. Now, this is after Daniel has given him the interpretation of this dream. Verse 46 says, "Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrant incense." Nebuchadnezzar is treating Daniel like a god. And he's doing that because he understands that no one would be able to tell him his dream plus the interpretation unless God told him. He specifically knew, he made the tests so that that would be the case. Verse 47, "The king answered Daniel and said, 'Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery.'" And it goes on to say that the king promoted Daniel, gave him many gifts, and placed him in a very high position in the Babylonian government. Now, we know that the king's frame of reference was still wrong. You know, in the very next chapter, he makes this statue of himself and wants people to bow down and worship it. You know, he's not saved, okay? But Daniel is placed there to impact this king with the message of who God is. So, in chapter 4, the king has another dream. And he has a dream about a tree that is growing. And it's very luxuriant, and it's very large, and birds are making nests in this tree. This tree is huge. And an angelic being descends from heaven and orders that it be chopped down. Now, let's follow the account of where Daniel interprets the dream for the king. Let's turn to chapter 4, verse 19. 4:19. "Then Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar, was appalled for a while his thoughts alarmed him." Daniel was troubled by what he understood the meaning of the dream to be. "The king responded and said, 'Belshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation alarm you.' Belteshazzar replied, 'My lord, if only the dream applied to those who hate you and its interpretation to your adversaries. The tree that you saw, which becomes large and grew strong, whose height reached to the sky and was visible to all the earth, and whose foliage was beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwell, and whose branches the birds of the sky lodged, it is you, O king. For you have become great and grown strong, and your majesty has become great and reached to the sky, and your dominion to the end of the earth. In that the king saw an angelic watcher, a holy one, descending from heaven and saying, 'Chop down the tree and destroy it, yet leave a stump with its roots in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze around it, in the new grass of the field, and let him be drenched with the dew of the heaven. Let him share with the beasts of the field until 7 periods of times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that you be driven away from mankind, that your dwelling place be with the beasts of the field, and you be given to grass to eat like cattle, and be drenched with the dew of heaven, and 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. So Daniel gives him the interpretation. The tree is you, O king. Your kingdom is going to be removed from you, and you're going to be driven away from mankind, and you're going to be eating grass like cattle. That sounds kind of bizarre. But that's what happens. If you read further in verse 28 here, Nebuchadnezzar becomes insane. You know, he first, you know, in verse 28, 29, it says, 12 months later, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace in Babylon, and the king reflected and said, is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence of the might of my power and the glory of my majesty? And while the word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared, sovereignty has been removed from you, and you will be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field. And you see this judgment, and he goes insane. 7 periods of time. It doesn't say how long that is. It's likely 7 years. But let's look down, skip down a couple of verses to verse 34. At the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, now this is in Nebuchadnezzar's voice here, raised my eyes towards heaven, my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are to be accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the hosts of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? This is the pagan king of Babylon speaking. I would say Daniel had some effect on this man. But God obviously was dealing in his heart as well. The king came to understand who God was and that he needed to worship him as the Lord of heaven and earth. Daniel had this ministry, not just in the life of Nebuchadnezzar, but in the life of Belshazzar, the next king, with the writing on the wall. There's a lot of cliches that come from this, you know, the writing on the wall. We see the writing on the wall. That comes from this book. Telling him that God would replace his kingdom and the kingdom with the Medes and the Persians. He fulfilled it also in the life of Darius, the king of the Medes, the kingdom that came after the Babylonians, just as God ordained that it would. After the incident with the lion's den, when Daniel was ambushed by these jealous, not-so-wise men and thrown into the den of lions, after God protected Daniel through the night, Darius, after he had disposed of the wicked wise men, made a decree. Look over at Daniel 6:25. This is after Daniel is brought out of the lion's den. This is after the wise men, their children, their wives were thrown into the lion's den. Then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language who were living in all the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. And his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Daniel was aware that God was working his purposes through these pagan kings, and he knew that the exile of the Jews was temporary, a 70-year affair prophesied by the book, by the prophet Jeremiah. Daniel understood that he was where God had placed him. In order that these kings would know that God was the one true God and that they needed to be worshipful of him. Daniel is an example of a godly, uncompromising life that has a great effect on those around him. Daniel is salt and light in the midst of these pagan societies. Now, Daniel was also placed where he was as an encouragement to the Jews. This people who had sinned repeatedly for centuries, and you can go back into the Kings and just see the nation of Israel just returning to idolatry over and over again. This people was taken captive and their land left desolate. And it would be easy for them to think that God had forsaken them or think that God was defeated and that there was no hope. Daniel's visions and prophecies spoke of the restoration of this people to the promised land, and it spoke of the coming of the Messiah. Chapter 9 contains very detailed prophecies concerning the coming of the Messiah. And many commentators show an amazing accuracy of this timeline, which Daniel's vision lays out, down to the very day of Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. Daniel's message was one of hope for the conquered Jews. This was not the end. This was judgment for their sins, but it was temporary. And it was part of the timeline that would see the coming of the Messiah. Daniel was an evangelist and a preacher of hope to the Jews. Now, the third thing that we see about Daniel's truth system is that Daniel's truth system told him that God must be obeyed. Now, this answers the worldview question, what is the basics of morality and ethics? What determines right and wrong? Daniel's answer, along with the answer of his three friends, was that God's law gave that basis. It formed the bedrock of the definition of right and wrong. We don't get to make up what we think is right and wrong. God's law defines what's right and wrong. The words from God's mouth determines what is right and wrong. Now, the Babylonians would like them to believe that God was defeated. We're going to take God, we're going to put him aside. He was out of the picture. And that their culture, their society, and their gods now determined what was right and wrong in the lives of these young men. Daniel and his friends knew that God's law still held true, that his law superseded man's law, and that God must be obeyed. Now we see this in Daniel's appeal in the first chapter that we looked at last week. We see this in the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And you remember the story. You know, we've got it on the flannel graph back there in the kids' room. Nebuchadnezzar set up this golden image of himself, 90 feet high, and commanded that all the leaders in the kingdom bow down to it and worship it as a sign of loyalty and recognizing his sovereignty over them. And when the time came to bow, when the music played, these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, did not bow. They served a higher law. And we can all recite for ourselves the first couple of verses of the Ten Commandments, right? Thou shalt have no other God before me. Thou shalt not worship any graven image. Out of the top ten, right? They knew that to worship anything or anyone other than God was a sin against God himself. And when they were brought before the king, he was ready to give them a second chance. Maybe you didn't understand. Maybe you hadn't heard. Well, let's pick up the account in chapter 3, verse 14. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready," again, he's giving them a second chance here, "at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe," that was the symphony orchestra of the time, "and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. All is forgiven. But if you do not worship, you will be immediately be cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Now that's being pretty narrow-minded, isn't it? I find this last verse very striking. Even if he does not save us, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the image. Even if our God does not deliver us, we're going to obey him. That's a truth system on display. Regardless of whether we are saved from this fiery furnace, we will do what our God says. Because it's true. And truth is not arbitrary. It's an absolute. Regardless of the consequences, we will obey God's law. That's the same thing that's been said throughout history, on down through the Reformation, through, you know, people say, we're going to obey God rather than men. Truth systems will do that for you. What you believe to be true will impact the way that you act. Now, we all have truth systems, whether we think about them or not. Every one of us, whether we are a believer in Jesus Christ or an unbeliever or a Muslim or a Buddhist, every one of us has a truth system and we act upon it. I can look at your actions and I can see what your truth system is. It's true for all of us. The difference is what that truth system is based upon. Whether it's based on society, whether your culture determines it, whether it's based on the writings of some man, or whether it's based on the Word of God. So to summarize today, Daniel's truth system told him that God was sovereign and acting in the affairs of men. God is the ruler, and he is working here and now. And all of these things that are happening are a result of God's ruling. It also told him that he was placed where he was for a specific purpose, that he was to live a godly, uncompromising life as a light to the Gentiles and as a hope for his Jewish brothers. It also told him that God's laws were to be obeyed, that God's law superseded man's law. Now, how about you? Do you see God active and working? Is a purpose in the affairs of your life? What is God doing in your life right now? There's a question you can ask each other over coffee a little bit from now. Because I think it's a valid question. What is God doing in your life? What is he teaching you? Do you understand why you are here? What purpose does God have for you in this place, this life that you live? What determines right and wrong for you? Do your friends define it? Does culture define it? Does MTV define it? What is your standard? Now, if you're not a believer in Jesus Christ, that is the first step. Without your heart being remade by God and your being freed from the slavery to sin, you have no hope of following God's ways. You just can't do it all on your own. God has to remake you, and then you can follow him. And I pray that God will work in your life to help us all examine these important questions. Okay, so I have time for a couple of questions here. How would the world answer the question, what is the basis for morality and ethics? How you feel? Okay. Different for everybody. Right. Got to be green. That's right.
Depends on your culture. You said, you know, respecting culture.
Yeah, culture is very important these days. You know, you can always claim that my culture tells me that it's okay to kill baby seals or something. I don't know. Right? But you hear that. Your culture defines your truth system. And you also hear the fact that your truth system and my truth system can be entirely different. And they're both okay. They're both equally valid. Which I find interesting. Because even the guys who flew the planes into the World Trade Center, they were just acting according to their culture, right? So really, what they did was valid as well.
But you know, that's interesting. I mean, that produces a conflict in most people. Even though this whole relativistic approach to ethics and, you know, knowledge and things like that as far as what is truth, but there's that thing deep down inside that people want, they would rebel against that
idea. Oh, sure.
So, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember the services that they had right after 9/11. You remember? And they had, you know, it was one big Kumbaya moment. You know, we had the the Christian guy there and the Jewish guy there and the Muslim guys there. And, you know, it was all just one big group hug. And there was no formulating going on, but there was still this message that we're all okay. And I think you're right. I think that causes this conflict in people. It's like, well, wait a second. That can't be true. You know, this one group thinks it's completely valid to kill innocent lives. And, you know, most of us were brought up to believe that even in warfare, you do not kill innocent life. So I think you're right. That causes conflict in people, and they go, that can't be true, right?
You notice the approach to be able to live with that was to marginalize them as being, well, they're radical.
They're extremists.
They're not within the mainstream of Muslim thought,
right,
as far as this whole thing.
Right.
You know, so and that's where you see in this country where, okay, especially what they would, you know, a lot of people, fundamentalism, and that's especially those who would advocate a truth that is absolute. Those,
right.
You know, so.
Yeah, I don't know if you all have noticed it or not, but they paint us. Those who would follow this book unquestioningly are painted with the same brush that the terrorists are.
Right.
We're fundamentalists.
Right.
And ignorant.
We're literalists when it comes to the scripture.
Right.
I think what you're describing, Tim, is what gives us tremendous opportunity for the gospel. Because people know it doesn't work when somebody's flying a plane into the building. They can pretend most of the time something drastic happens. Not just on that scale, but okay, now that guy's view of truth cost me.
Right. Absolutely.
So many times I think we get all caught up in this angst over it's not going well. Well, you know, it's not, but there's the opportunity, because the more it doesn't go well, the more people's hopes and dreams are going to be shattered by their erroneous view of reality. And we have a chance to come in and say, yeah, no, you've misunderstood who God is.
Yeah.
You know, Dave, you say that. I listened to on the iTunes this two-part series by a gentleman from Theology Unplugged, and it's called "What Does God Think of Barack Obama?" And this is right after the election had occurred. It's a two-part. If you want to listen to something that deals with this aspect as Christians, you know, how should we feel in light of the things that are going on? And he deals with this whole issue of the sovereignty of God, and how we should look at things in a way. I mean, it is excellent. It's a two-part series called, you know, "What Does God Think of Barack Obama?" And the guy really hits it on the nail.
Yeah, I mean, look at Daniel. Daniel is not depressed. Daniel is not upset that, you know, he's in this situation. Daniel says, "Here I am, God. What would you have me do?" He is willing to be used by God in this difficult situation. He wants to be where God is working. And he wants to be submissive to what God is doing. Daniel doesn't have his own agenda. He's not, you know, out there campaigning for, you know, God is using him. So, if you believe that God is sovereign and active in the affairs of men, how do you view difficulties that come into our lives?
Testing of your faith.
Testing of your faith? Okay.
Building your faith.
Building your faith?
Count it all joy?
Okay. Yeah, you have to look at the big picture. What is God doing?
Seems like the largest steps of growth to come were on the hardship also. Seems like we draw closer to God than we're in the hardships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Book of James says, count it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials.
God said to even the exiles that he was punishing, build your houses and live. Pray for your leaders that the culture in general will be blessed. You know, mm-hmm. He's not saying, you know, here's your bed, lie in it. Yes, he is, but he is also saying, live your life.
Right. Yeah, I heard once somebody said, find out what God is doing and go there. That's what you see all through the New Testament. You know, Jesus teaches us to pray, Lord, not my will, but thy will be done. Right? Whatever you ask in my name, according to my will, according to my purposes, that I will do, because we're going in the same direction God is going in, and of course it's going to happen. We've placed our agenda aside and we're after what God wants. Okay, we are out of time. Let's pray.